Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi and thanks for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Some great topics this week. Can your important health information be accessed easily by those trying to help you in a medical emergency?
70% plus people said they didn't carry any kind of emergency contact details with them. And those that do probably have them on their phone somewhere, but that's probably password protected.
Dr. Dawn Harper of Embarrassing Bodies fame has a method that can help with this. Then what might this be the symptoms of?
But you can get all sorts of symptoms, you know, headaches, dizziness, chest pains, palpitations, stomach upsets, all of that sort of stuff.
These are just a few of the symptoms that can come with burnout. And Dr. Claire Ashley talks about burnout, all the symptoms and what to do if you experience it. So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. Before my first guest today, I just want to tell you something that I'm up to. Now, as well as the perfect face for radio, I've also got the perfect body for radio, and I've actually decided to try and do something about it. I've started an exercise regime, and I've got a Watt Bike exercise bike set up in my office. It's right by my desk here. I'm looking at it now, and I have started a program of exercise on the Watt Bike using the Watt Bike app. It's about 3 months long, and one month in, I do three sessions a week, and those sessions are, say, between 15 to 30 minutes. It varies depending what the program throws up, and I'm feeling really good. I'm definitely feeling fitter. I feel like I've got a little bit more energy, and if you like the sound of that, you can actually join me, because I'm streaming my exercise sessions on YouTube, on my YouTube channel, which is called Relax Back UK, the same as the show. So you can join me, watch me. You can even pedal along with me. You don't have to have a Watt bike, any sort of exercise bike. And you don't have to go at the same speed. You can just come along for a gentle pedal. There's often a little bit of chat involved as well. So, you know, you can see what's happening, what I'm thinking about, and that kind of thing. So why don't you come along and join me? Now, on to the first guest today, a Dr. Dawn Harper, who we all know from Embarrassing Bodies, and the topic is how bad we are at looking at various aspects of our health and information that we really should know. Now, as I said, she's from Embarrassing Bodies, and my first question to her was, what is the latest on Embarrassing Bodies? There was a bit of a revival recently, but what is the latest with the show?
Yeah, okay, so we haven't filmed anything new with the original team for, I'm going to say nearly 10 years now. But it was an incredible experience. I really enjoyed working on Embarrassing Bodies, and we made over 100 episodes, and it's been sold to, I'm told, 120 different countries. So you would be amazed what I've been shown in the most public of places and all around the world. I remember going to the Kruger National Park, and the airport in Kruger is tiny. You know, it's a tiny building. And this lovely guy came over to me. I remember I had big sunglasses on, my hair was up, I was completely out of Embarrassing Bodies character, you know, and this lovely guy came up to me and he said, "Oh my word, are you Dr. Dawn from Embarrassing Bodies?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, can I have a selfie? My wife loves you." And my husband said, "I can't believe this, we're in the middle of Africa." So it's all around the world still. So, and I'm told that you can get it on all sorts of streaming channels and what have you, so it's still out there. But we're not doing anything new.
It's still going strong. So what are you up to now?
So I'm still very much an NHS GP, so still practicing in general practice. I write for a few magazines. I do a few campaigns like this that that I believe in, and I work on some NHS campaigns. I guess probably the most that I do now, I work with a few companies. One continuous glucose monitor called Dual Anytime, that is I think the most cost effective actually at market at the moment. I work with some retirement villages, with Rangeford villages on health and well-being, and I do a lot of facilitating and chairing medical conferences. So
Right.
I've just come
Okay.
back from Denver and Milan. So yeah, I'm not retiring, just
Right. So you are using your fame from embarrassing bodies for good.
I hope so.
For the good of the
Yeah,
world.
I hope
Good. Which kind of leads nicely onto the topic for today, which is how clueless many of us are about some pretty basic facts about our health. And the list that I saw on the press release, there was a list that came out, and the one at the top was blood type. And I give blood, and I have given blood quite a lot. And I thought, oh, I give blood, I must know what my blood type is. So I sat down and I thought, actually, I don't know what my blood type is. I had to find out my little card that at least I had it. It was in my wallet, so I could find it. But is am I pretty normal, being that useless?
I don't think it's useless, but I think most of us don't know, or certainly the thing that, so the company that I'm working with on this is called MyCode, and they conducted a survey of over 2,000 people and asked them questions about things like, do you know this, and you know, what's your medical contact details, and so on. And the thing that really struck me, Mike, was that 70% plus people said they didn't carry any kind of emergency contact details with them. And those that do probably have them on their phone somewhere, but that's probably password protected. So in an emergency, people can't necessarily get to your information. And I think what that highlighted, I mean, the guy that set this up is he's a fascinating guy. His name is Professor James Ohinajan. And his brother was, he had MS from a young age, and towards the end he couldn't talk. And of course that meant that when he needed emergency medical help, he couldn't communicate stuff to them. And James's brother had an unusual form of MS where he shook a lot. And so there were a number of occasions where he was in contact with the emergency services and they assumed that he was having an epileptic fit. He wasn't. That was part of his MS. But you can see how, in an emergency situation without information at hand, he would be treated inappropriately. So
And
what
that could
James.
actually be very dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. So what James has done is he's created this MyCode, which is effectively, it's just a QR code. It's a personalized QR code. So you go to mycode.uk and you buy your own QR code that comes to you in a pack. And you have a number of different ways of keeping that QR code. You might have a sticker on the back of your phone. You might have a key ring. You might have a wristband. You might have a credit card. And you register your own personal information to that QR code. What that means is, if I was to collapse in the street, then the emergency services, when they arrive, they can scan that QR code and they will immediately get my medical information. We know that one in four UK adults have a long-term medical condition. They'll immediately know that. In James's brother's situation, they would immediately find out that he's not epileptic and that this is part of his MS. And
I
what's
mean, this is obviously vital, but I'm thinking, surely all this information is sloshing around in the NHS somewhere.
Exactly, it absolutely it is, but it's not necessarily with me when I collapse in the street. So
Sure.
this is a way of getting instant access, making sure that my next of kin, so my husband, would be informed straight away and would know that I was being taken to XYZ hospital. What's incredible about, I mean, the bit that really blows my mind about the My Code, Mike, is that, say I collapse in the street in Paris, if a French phone scans my English QR code, my code, all that information will be automatically translated into French.
Okay, well,
So that the
that's very
emergency
interesting.
services, wherever I am in the world, have instant access to my medical record. And I choose what goes on there.
And
Okay,
but this
it's
is
not just going
information.
into your NHS record, it is what I choose to put on there.
That was going to be my question, actually. It's not accessing the information that is sloshing around in the NHS. It's stuff that you put on. Because actually, that's been an issue for a while, hasn't it? Because that the NHS is kind of fragmented. So you might have information at your GP and some at your local hospital and stuff like this. And I'm pretty sure there has been talk and various projects to try and kind of bring all this together within the NHS. Is something like that still happening, or has that been sort of given up as it's just far too difficult?
We are definitely trying to be more collaborative, if you like. So I remember back in the old days being on call, and you would get if somebody was admitted to hospital, that discharge summary didn't automatically talk to my GP record. And so we're working to make sure that everybody talks together. But the thing about the My Code is, let's say, for example, I'm a younger woman and maybe I've had a termination of pregnancy, and that's very personal and I don't want people to know about that. The My Code doesn't automatically access your entire medical record. You put on that what you want and what you think an emergency situation might need to know. So they wouldn't need to know that. But they might need to know, let's say, that I'm asthmatic or that I live with diabetes. So though, and they might want to, they might definitely would want to know, for example, what medicines I'm on. So to know what medicines interact with what, they need to know what medicines I'm on. They'd certainly want to know. So when I'm filling in my MyCode, I would want people to know if I have any allergies. Really important that we know about allergies and so on. So it's a personalised record that you can update. And it just means that, you know, we all hope we don't need it, don't we? We all hope that we're not going to have an emergency situation. But if you did find yourself in that awful situation where you're semi-conscious, you're unconscious, you can't communicate your own medical problems, then the emergency services scan this QR code. It's got a little green cross in the middle of it so that people know that is what this is. It's a medical record, and they will automatically get access to the information that I think they need in an emergency.
Yeah, I can see that would be very useful. But having said that, there is an NHS app, isn't there? Such a thing exists kind of there already, which does has information on. And I can't help thinking that somehow using something that exists already might be kind of a good plan, because the NHS app, although it doesn't have all our stuff on it, it does kind of cover across quite a lot of things. And I think it's got a list of, so as an example, so I have to take pills because I've got high blood pressure. Now I know I take two pills every morning, so at least I know that much. But if you ask me the name of them and the strength of them, I'd be struggling. But I could find it on the NHS app. And that information is sucked out the NHS. Yes. Okay. Now there's, I'm not embarrassed or worried about other people knowing that for sure. But I can't help thinking using something that exists and gets information out the NHS seems like a pretty good starting point. So, I don't know. Does this system doesn't really do that, does it? It sort of runs parallel.
This is a standalone thing that you as an individual might chooses what should be available on that. You're absolutely right. The NHS app is brilliant. It will have your repeat medications, your conditions. And we now, you know, we even have that, for example, if I see you in my surgery, you can access what I wrote in your notes. Okay, so you can get all of that. The problem with that, and it's not a problem because it's private. And so in order for me to access my information on my NHS app, I have to put in my username and my password, and then I can share that with you, with the ambulance service, with somebody in A&E, so that they can see I can share that with them. But it requires me to access my phone and then access the app.
So, yeah, you've got to be conscious.
Yes.
So, you know,
yes. And choose to do that. And that's really great because you can. And so many people don't remember what medicines they're on or the name of the drugs that they might be allergic to or so on. And so if you're conscious, you can share that with anybody. If you're not conscious, they can't access that app.
Yeah.
You know, if your phone's off, you can't even get into to look at, you know, emergency contacts or so on. You can't. And that's right. I mean, we shouldn't be in a situation where anybody can pick up anybody's phone and just get into all their private messaging and their private medical information. So this is different. It's a standalone thing. You can choose to put all of your medical history on it if you want. You can, you know, you can talk through everything. I could put on there that I had an appendectomy when I was 12. That's not really relevant, so I probably wouldn't choose to. But actually, to know what medicines I'm on, what I'm allergic to, my husband's contact details, that is something that I would want somebody who found me unconscious in the street to be able to access.
And actually thinking about it, when I'm trying to get into my app, any app, it doesn't have to be just the NHS app, and I've got to remember a password. You know, when I'm comfortable at home drinking a cup of coffee in front of the computer, I have enough trouble then. So if I'm injured in A&E or I'm accompanying someone who's injured and I'm just in a different frame of mind, you know, well, frankly, I'm probably going to be panicked.
Of course.
I won't remember these things then, probably.
No. I think this is a really great little initiative. I think it just puts you in control. And it means that, you know, none of us want to be in an emergency situation. Nobody plans to go out on a Monday morning and find themselves in A&E on Monday afternoon, do they?
Yeah.
But unfortunately, things happen. You know, accidents happen, medical emergencies happen. And if you've got this kind of information, it just means it makes, for example, my life, maybe as a medic arriving on the scene, it makes my life easier. I've suddenly got the emergency information that I need straight away.
And in some ways, it opens a bigger question, because we have the NHS. The NHS is wonderful. I am a big lover of the NHS. I can see you nodding your head.
You and me both. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. However, we do have our own personal responsibility. You know, we've got to look after ourselves. And if we do that as much as possible, that'll kind of lower the burden on the NHS. So I think there's an awful lot of things we can do to help if we sort of try and take note of some of these things that are important. So, OK, blood type came up. You know, that's obviously an important one. That's good to know. But Can you sort of give us a list of other things that we really should know about ourselves? Perhaps we can put them on this app, or we can write them on a piece of paper, whatever. But that's almost another question. For being responsible, what sort of things should we know about ourselves and our loved ones?
So, Mike, you're completely speaking my language. I refer to the NHS as mum. And I say, you know, for most of us living in the UK today, she's always been around. And sometimes that can mean maybe we take her for granted. Maybe we criticise her a little bit. But, you know, we all know that if we lose her, we're going to really miss her. And I do think we've spent a lot of time over recent years talking about rights. And I love the fact that you've just mentioned responsibilities. So we do all have a responsibility to look after ourselves, and in doing so, then look after the NHS so that she's around for your kids and your grandkids and my kids and my grandkids. So I think there are a few things that everybody should know. So I think certainly anybody over 40 should know their blood pressure and their cholesterol. And if you have a family history of those problems, possibly even sooner. Contrary to popular belief, you know, most people don't get headaches or blurred vision or with high blood pressure. Most people have no symptoms whatsoever. And the same with cholesterol.
Yeah, if you don't test, you don't know. Completely by accident.
There you go. So I think we should certainly know that. And I think it's really important to know a family history. So many people, this is one of the things that came up in the MyCode survey, so many people don't know about their family history. Now, some people tell me that they don't want to know, because they don't want to know that they might have a genetic predisposition to diabetes, to thyroid problems, to rheumatoid arthritis, to some forms of cancer. I would argue the opposite. I would say, well, okay, we can't change our genes yet. There will probably be a time in the future that we may be able to. We can't change our genes. But most conditions are what we call multifactorial. So there will be other things. So let's talk about breast cancer, for example. If you carry the BRCA gene, then we know that you have a very much increased risk of developing breast cancer. Now, What you might do, so in fact, we had a, I think it was three sisters in embarrassing bodies who were testing because they had a family history. One was negative, but two were positive. One opted to have an elective bilateral mastectomy so that she couldn't develop breast cancer in her breast tissue. The other opted not to, but decided, but looked at all the other things that can raise your risk of blood pressure, of breast cancer, things like being overweight, drinking more alcohol, so the lifestyle factors. And what she did was she took that potentially devastating news that she had a genetic predisposition, so she was, you know, much more likely than me, for example, to develop breast cancer, but she really addressed the lifestyle issues to try to mitigate that risk. So I think it's really important that we know things about ourselves.
Can
And
I
I
ask
would,
an unfair
yeah,
question about that
of
story?
course.
That was from
Yes.
Embarrassing Bodies. Has there
Yes.
been any follow-up? How are the sisters doing?
Yeah, sadly, we did do follow-ups on people back in the day, but of course, we haven't filmed anything new for 10 years. So I don't know how they are now. I
I told
hope
you it was
they're all
unfair.
well. Well, no, that's not unfair at all. You know, I hope they're all well, and I hope if they get to listen to this, please do get in touch with Maverick Television and let us know how you're doing, because I know they would pass that on. I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I'll get them on the show here. I'd love to chat to them. Okay, but well, that's an excellent example, really, of and it's not that hard to do, is it? It's, you know, it's relatively sensible, and most people probably like to think that they're doing things, having a relatively healthy lifestyle. Mind you, what you think and what you do can be very, very different. But it's, you know, it doesn't do any harm at all. Other things that are useful, you mentioned it already, emergency contact numbers.
Yes.
Got me
Yeah.
thinking, actually. You know, I've got a thick wallet full of, not because it's full of money, because it's full of all the detritus from every day. And it's got a photo of my daughter in. Has it got a photo of my wife? I don't know, but it hasn't got any telephone numbers and stuff like
No.
that, actually, I don't
No,
think.
and also somebody's got to rifle through your wallet to find that stuff. If actually you've got a sticker on the back of your wallet, which has got the my code on it, it's instant. It's straight away, people have got the information that they need. They haven't got to rifle through. Just like you, I've got a thick wallet. It's usually full of receipts, not no. Well, actually, most of us don't carry much in the way of cash these days, do we?
No,
So
no, no.
yes.
It's
So what?
full of other rubbish.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is probably a very good time to sort of bring things to a close, maybe. And if people are listening, just to give them a good source of information of two things, really. The kind of medical stuff that they really should know and get out of their way to try and find out. And once they've done that, you know, what can they do with it? Where they can keep it? Just some good sources of information, probably websites.
Absolutely. So I think everybody should know their family history. They need to know the medicines that they're on, anything that they're allergic to, and they need to have access to, they need to know who to contact. People need to know who to contact in an emergency. So all of that, I think, should be on your My Code if you buy a My Code, and that's just from mycode.uk. I would encourage everybody to download the NHS app and use it, because just as the situation that you mentioned earlier, you know, when you're conscious, you can access your app, and you can then communicate whatever information you need to anybody who's looking after you medically. So, and I'm a huge fan of the NHS website. I think there's a lot of really good information there. And so, but I think probably I would say have a little look at mycode.uk and make sure that you have the NHS app registered
Excellent.
on your phone.
Dr. Dawn Harper, thank you very much indeed for taking a few minutes to chat today.
Thank you for having me.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
At the start of the show, I mentioned my new exercise program on my Watt bike, which I'm really enjoying. And I also mentioned that I'm streaming the exercise sessions three times a week, but I didn't say when. They're being streamed on my YouTube channel, which is Relax Back UK. They are happening on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays at 12:30. So you can come and join me if you like. You're really welcome. You don't need a fancy bike, any sort of exercise bike will do. You can go at any speed you'd like. You can just have a very gentle pedal for the whole thing. You can watch. There'll be a bit of gossip. But please do come join us. I'm really enjoying it and I hope you will too. Now on to the next guest. My next guest is Dr. Claire Ashley. She's a GP, but she also has a particular interest. And my first question was, what is that particular interest that you have?
Yeah, so I mean, as a GP, I would say I'm an expert generalist because we don't specialise in one thing, we specialise in people, I would say. But yes, my particular specialist interest and expertise is in mental health and well-being, and in particular in burnout. And there is a very good reason for this. First of all, from a clinical perspective, I really do enjoy working with patients with mental health difficulties, and I find it a really rewarding aspect of my work. But unfortunately for me, I have also experienced the effects of stress overwhelm, right. And I've been in burnout myself. And okay. So, yeah, I can understand it both from a clinical perspective and from an academic perspective, right. As well, because I have a degree in neuroscience, but also from lived experience.
Well, you're perfectly positioned to think about my first question then, really, because what I want to try and get a handle on is experiencing burnout. This is not just a crummy day and feeling a bit worn out. I suppose the first question is what are the symptoms and what does it feel like, if it's possible to kind of to explain?
Yeah, so I mean, what might be helpful then is if I talk about the official definition and then what it felt like, you know, what sure. It can feel like for people to experience it. Yeah. So the official definition given by the World Health Organization is very dry. They say that burnout is an occupational syndrome that arises as the result of unsuccessfully managed workplace stress. And the definition is very narrow in that it only recognises burnout as occurring in the workplace. But I personally disagree with this because I believe very strongly that unpaid work can lead to burnout as well, or any situation that causes prolonged stress. And, you know, I'm thinking particularly about people that are parents and caregivers in this context. And there are three core components to it. So they are depersonalization, so that's cynicism, that's apathy, that's detachment, and just not caring anymore. The second is emotional exhaustion, so that's feeling deeply fatigued and just being completely tapped out, having nothing left in the tank, you know. Mm-hmm. And the third component is reduced performance at work in whatever form that takes for you. But what that definition doesn't really explain is the symptoms. And I like to categorize the symptoms into three things: physical, mental, emotional. So physical symptoms, burnout's very physical experience. The most commonly reported symptom with burnout is muscular aches and pains and tension. There's a
Okay, so physical pain as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. By far and away the most commonly reported problem, alongside fatigue. That's the other, and really disproportionate fatigue as well. But that can also be tied in with sleep disturbance, which is also very common with burnout. But you can get all sorts of symptoms, you know, headaches, dizziness, chest pains, palpitations, stomach upsets, all of that sort of stuff. Then you've got your emotional and your mental, and depending where you're at in terms of your burnout, there are some kind of key features that, yeah, and things that happen to pretty much everyone. So one of them is the experience of guilt and shame. So guilt is actually considered to be such a pervasive experience in burnout that it should, some researchers argue that it should form part of the definition. There's also emotional dysregulation. So that's the inability to control your emotions anymore. So flying off the handle over the smallest of things, getting angry, resentful, sad, bursting into tears, that sort of thing. There's also low mood, you know, it affects your mood. You know, a lot of people with burnout also feel very worried, very anxious, very panicky, might have panic attacks, might feel very low, very depressed, very unmotivated. But despite feeling that like this, you're still going to work, you're still showing up for other people. And then finally, you have effects on executive function. So that's things like your memory, your concentration and your focus. Those things really start to be affected in burnout as well. So it really, it's an all-encompassing experience. And
I mean, it sounds like there's not a part of your life it doesn't touch, actually.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. And, you know, and it can ruin your professional life. It can ruin your home life as well.
Blimey. All right. How common is it? I mean, how many people, just maybe think about the UK, how many people suffer from it in the UK? Does anyone know?
Yeah, I can't recall off the top of my head exactly what the figures are right now, but there was some work done about a year ago or so that said that I think it was 85% of UK workers had experienced some degree of burnout in the prior 2 years. And we've also just had this new research commissioned by OnePlus come out, which is talking about this time of year being a very overwhelming and stressful time of year. And they refer to burnout season being, you know, the peak, the time when mental loads and stress peaks from the 5th of November to the 11th of December. And that equates to 24.5 million Brits feeling the effects of stress and overwhelm. Now, not all of the people in that group are going to be burnt out, but that just gives you an idea about that the degree of, you know, how many people are affected by this. And obviously stress and burnout exist on a spectrum, and some people will be massively burnt out and some people will not be. Mm-hmm. And the other thing you can look at is the cost to, you know, in terms of sickness absence. You know, the majority of people that are off sick, unfortunately, because of mental health problems, and the bill is 86 billion a year. So, you know, this is something that costs us on an individual and a societal level as well.
Okay, right. Well, maybe you've described beautifully what it is, and you know, it's just horrible. What about some causes? You sort of touched on a few causes. Perhaps mm-hmm. we could just kind of look at that in a little bit more detail. What are the main causes?
So if you're thinking about workplace burnout, there are six factors that have been identified in the literature as causing that. And they are to do primarily with workload, feelings of control, fairness, community, being able to work in alignment with your values and feeling rewarded by your work. And if you have any of those things out of balance in the context of prolonged stress, then you run the risk of burnout. Then you also have your individual risk factors. So that's things like, and this is not to blame individuals, obviously, it's just that these things prime people. It's things like personality type, whether or not you're neurodivergent. If you are an introvert working in an extroverted job, for instance, then you're at increased risk of burnout.
That was going to be one of my questions, as it is. Yeah. You know, could it be you're just in the wrong job?
Potentially, yes. If the job isn't a good fit for you, then you run the risk of burnout. Absolutely. And then there's also things like imposter syndrome, perfectionism, people pleasing. And then you also have to think about stresses outside of work. So there are demographic groups who experience more stress and are more likely to burn out in work. So working mothers, and in particular, it's Black, Asian and Latina mothers. And you can understand that because that demographic are more likely to experience microaggressions and discrimination. And at this particular time of year,
are they? Is that a fact? Is that like a kind of peer-reviewed published fact?
So this data comes from a big study that was done in the US in 2020 by the Maven Clinic, who are a very reputable, very large clinic based in the US. I can't recall which journal it has been published in, so I'm assuming that it is peer reviewed, but don't take my words on that. And then, as I was saying,
that's quite a sweeping statement. But anyway, issues at home, I can see how that can be a problem. One thing I was thinking, and this probably ties into work as well, this the always on culture, and by that I kind of mean social media, and certainly your boss can send you a message at any time of the day. Hopefully he doesn't think you're necessarily going to read it, but you know, he can send you an email in the middle of the night. This kind of thing is that creeping in?
Yes. So some of the literature around burnout tells us that smartphones can hamper burnout recovery and can also lead to that breakdown of work-life balance. And it's because there's the always on culture. And not just that, but people are so conditioned to get their phones out throughout the day. You know, I think about how many times you automatically reach for your phone and then how much you do that when you're not supposed to be working, right? And, you know, people have their emails on their phones, they have their WhatsApp, you know, their work WhatsApp groups and all of that sort of stuff. And so a large part of managing burnout risk and stress management is about having those boundaries around when, how and when you can be contacted and how and when you are available for work. And that's difficult to do because the expectation is quite often that you're available to, you know, on your phone. You know, you've got your phone on you 24/7, you know, but you have to be very boundaried and say, no, do you know what, after a certain time at night, I'm not answering, you know, but that's difficult to do.
Yeah. And another thing you mentioned was whether you actually find what you do worthwhile, or maybe whether you think other people think what you do is worthwhile. Does that sort of come up a lot when you're dealing with people who are suffering from this?
I find my work in this space to be very values aligned. So I really enjoy sharing my knowledge and helping other people who are in similar situations to when I burnt out. Because I still feel like there's a lack of knowledge and a lack of skill set around how to manage stress appropriately, particularly in the context of workplace stress. And I get so many, I'm very fortunate that people reach out to me and tell me how helpful things like my book are, for instance. And so I maybe get one or two emails a week with people, you know, strangers just reaching out and saying, thank you so much. I really appreciate the work that you've done. Right. So yes, absolutely. It's incredibly rewarding.
Okay, so the work you're doing, whether it's kind of you feel it's important to other people, is going to have a factor on whether you reach burnout or not. Sounds like it.
Yes, so that's part of the, so yes, if you're working in alignment with your values, that's protective against burnout.
Yeah, okay, good. What about long COVID? Because lots of people actually had long COVID and it caused all kinds of different symptoms. Yeah. And a lot of them actually kind of sounded somewhat similar to what you described at the start. But I don't know this for a fact. I kind of suspect, because I know a lot of people did have the effects of for a long time after COVID. Are there a lot of people still kind of dealing with long COVID and other kind of long problems, other viruses that are still sort of lurking and causing similar issues?
Yes, I mean, there are still a handful of patients suffering with long COVID, thankfully less than maybe 2 or 3 years ago. The symptoms of long COVID and in fact, any sort of, you know, hangover effect, I guess, I don't want to call it that because it's not, it's very real, it's very genuine. But, you know, any virus that causes prolonged fatigue, you know, you're talking about a chronic fatigue type picture there, aren't you?
That was the phrase I was looking for. Yeah, I forgot the phrase, but yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And the thing with chronic fatigue, and what's very interesting is that a lot of the hormonal changes that happen in chronic fatigue and a lot of the brain changes as well are very similar to what happens in burnout. And so there is a bit of a crossover, in fact, between burnout, the symptoms and the bodily changes with chronic fatigue as well. And the difficulty with chronic fatigue is that there's a lack of understanding in the medical community about exactly what the causes are, although obviously we do recognise that post-viral fatigue is a thing, and also a lack of understanding and knowledge about really how to help people to get better. And that is quite a frustrating thing for patients to experience, and it's frustrating for their medical providers as well.
Okay, so which I suppose brings me on kind of nicely to the last topic that's definitely worth discussing. You know, if someone comes to you and you can diagnose them of, yeah, well, actually may well have burnout of some type, either very, you know, very seriously or a bit more mildly or what have you, you know, what can you do for them? You know, you can't just make a quick prescription and kind of say, there you go, on your way. That's when, once you've made a diagnosis, probably that's when it gets really hard. What then?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely spot on, because it's not just about having that diagnosis. It's then about that recovery period. And it's a 1 to 3 year average recovery period in burnout. So it's a significant amount of time during which people do feel like they're recovering and then they're sliding again. So it's not necessarily going to be linear. What it involves is, yes, medical support. If you've got, a mental health condition alongside your burnout, like anxiety and depression, for instance, or PTSD, quite often they go hand in hand. But then you also need to look at actually recovering, like genuinely resting, having some time away from work if you can, not always available to people, but taking some sick leave if that's available to you, looking at the work factors that caused your burnout, and then also the individual factors that caused your burnout, and their therapy and coaching can be very helpful, and maybe some career coaching as well. But really what you need to do is identify the root causes and to make some changes. And that can be really difficult, especially when you're recovering from burnout and you're not completely there yet. It's a time of intense vulnerability where you have to advocate for yourself, and that is very difficult. And so, yeah, I would say, it does get easier with time, but it does take time. You need to be compassionate to yourself and have a new respect for the fact that you are not going to be recovered for some period of time yet.
Right. Can the NHS help with this? I mean, I guess GPs can help, but we all know GPs are pretty pushed at the minute.
Yes, it is. It is difficult to access GPs at the moment. I would say that's probably the most obvious port of call. If you think that you're suffering with burnout, your GP will definitely be able to help you, potentially with a referral to a therapist if that's appropriate. But the other place that people can look for help is if they are working. Quite often employers provide, through employee assistance programs, they might provide access to GPs, but also to therapists or coaches. So that's the other place I would advise people to look for help.
Okay. All right, that sounds good. One, actually, maybe I should have asked this a little earlier, but I've just thought of it, so I'm going to ask it now. Can it ever mask maybe something that's a little more sinister? Not that burnout is not serious, but could someone come to you with actually a heart problem and they're showing all these symptoms, they're really tired, they've got aches, maybe backache, and all these kind of things that can show up with heart issues, and it masks something which is actually a bit more sinister?
Yeah, I mean, burnout is such a physical experience, as I said. And so, yes, there is every chance that someone could present with purely physical symptoms. And you mentioned the heart there. Actually, if you end up in burnout, you are more likely to have a heart attack because of the stress on your body. By the way, that risk gets better as you recover from burnout. So you go back to your baseline risk. As a doctor, certainly my approach to this would be, any patient that comes with a physical symptom, even if I think my hunch is that it's related to a mental health problem, is I would investigate that physical symptom first, just to make sure that, that box was ticked and that we weren't missing anything. And of course, people with heart problems can also get burnout. So the two things can coexist at the same time, which makes it even more tricky. I would never rush to, certainly for myself, I would never rush to say a physical symptom was related to a mental health problem without having done all of that first.
Okay, so lots of things to think about. Right, if people are listening to this and they're thinking, right, this may well describe me or, someone else in my family or someone I care for, where can they find more information, a good solid information source? Because there's an awful lot of health information on the internet which is wrong, dangerous, whatever. So somewhere that we can trust.
Yes, absolutely. If I can plug myself, if I may, I've written a book which is all about the evidence base behind the science of burnout. It's called The Burnout Doctor. It's incredibly practical, full of exercises to help people to both effectively prevent and recover from burnout. So that's available at all good bookstores. It's available online. You can also get it as a audiobook. And if people are interested in this research around seasonal burnout and stress and overwhelm, then the OnePlus website is a great place to look. And there's also some information on there about how technology can be leveraged to help you with your stress levels as well.
Right. But also, don't be afraid of trying to make an appointment with a GP.
Absolutely. Yes. I would say definitely first port of call, and particularly if people are really struggling with their mental health, any thoughts of self-harm, suicide, absolutely speak to your GP urgently.
All right. And how are you at the minute?
Do you know what, Mike? Thank you so much for asking. I'm really well. My burnout happened 6 years ago, and I was supported by NHS practitioner health to get better. So I had a GP and a therapist look after me, and I've been discharged now for 4 years, I think, and I've managed to stay well. I've made lots of changes to how I work. So I still practice as a GP, but much less. And a lot of my work now is around supporting people with burnout, and I really enjoy what I do. And yeah, and I'm
Good.
doing really well.
Good. Excellent. Very glad to hear it. And thank you again for taking the time to chat.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. And they were Dr. Dawn Harper talking about how we can make our medical information that's required, potentially required in an emergency, available to those that are helping us. And Dr. Claire Ashley talking about burnout. And thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Kiss me quick. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. The cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.